2. Ka-ching! The slot machine in Connie's garage went like a cartoon, Peter's features soaked in its rosy glow. He was 18, Connie's older brother, and his forearms were the color of toast. His friend Henry hovered at his side. Connie decided she had a crush on Henry, so our Friday night would be devoted to perching on the weightlifting bench. Henry's orange motorcycle parked beside us like a prize pony. We'd watch the boys play the slot machine, drinking the off-brand beer Connie's father kept in the garage fridge. Later they'd shoot the empty bottles with a BB gun, crowing at each glassy burst. I knew I'd see Peter that night, so I'd worn an embroidered shirt, my hair foul with hairspray. I dotted a pimple on my jaw with a beige putty of Merle Norman, but it collected along the rim and made it glow. As long as my hair stayed in place, I looked nice, or at least I thought so, and I tucked in my shirt to show the tops of my small breasts, the artificial press of cleavage from my bra. The feeling of exposure gave me an anxious pleasure that made me stand straighter, holding my head on my neck like an egg in a cup. Trying to be more like the black-haired girl in the park, that easy cast of her face. Connie narrowed her eyes when she saw me, a muscle by her mouth, twitching, but she didn't say anything. Peter had really only spoken to me for the first time 2 weeks before. I'd been waiting for Connie downstairs. Her bedroom was much smaller than mine, her house meaner, but we spent most of our time there. The house done up in a maritime theme, her father's misguided attempt to approximate female decoration. I felt bad for Connie's father, his night job at a dairy plant, the arthritic hands he clenched and unclenched nervously. Connie's mother lived somewhere in New Mexico, near a hot spring, had twin boys, and another life no one ever spoke of. For Christmas, she had once sent Connie a compact of cracked blush and a Fair Isle sweater that was so small neither of us could squeeze our head through the hole. "The colors are nice," I said, hopefully. Connie just shrugged. "She's a bitch." Peter crashed through the front door, dumping a book on the kitchen table. He nodded at me in his mild way and started making a sandwich, pulling out slices of white bread, an acid-bright jar of mustard. "Where's the princess?" he said. His mouth was chapped a violent pink, slightly coated, I imagined, with pot resin. "Getting a jacket." "Ah." He slapped the bread together and took a bite. He watched me while he chewed. "Looking good these days, Boyd," he said, then swallowed hard. His assessment knocked me so off balance that I felt I had almost imagined it. Was I even supposed to say anything back? I'd already memorized the sentence. He turned then at a noise from the front door, a girl in a denim jacket, her shape muffled by the screen. Pamela, his girlfriend. They were a constant couple, porous with each other, wearing similar clothes, silently passing the newspaper back and forth on the couch, or watching The Man from U.N.C.L.E., picking lint off each other as if from their own selves. I had seen Pamela at the high school, those times I'd ridden my bike past the dun-colored building. The rectangles of half-dry grass, the low, wide steps where older girls were always sitting in poor boy shirts, pinkies linked, palming packs of Kents, the whiff of death among them, their boyfriends in humid jungles. They were like adults, even in the way they flicked the ashes of their cigarettes with weary snaps of the wrist. "Hey, Evie," Pamela said. It was easy for some girls to be nice, to remember your name. Pamela was beautiful, it was true, and I felt that submerged attraction to her that everyone felt for the beautiful. The sleeves of her jean jacket were bulked at her elbows, her eyes doped-looking from liner. Her legs were tan and bare. My own legs were dotted with the pricks of mosquito bites I worried into open wounds. My calves hatched with pale hairs. "Babe," Peter said with his mouth full, and loped over to give her a hug, burying his face in her neck. Pamela squealed and pushed him away. When she laughed, her snaggletooth flashed. "Beyond foul," Connie whispered, entering the room. But I was quiet, trying to imagine how that would feel. To be so known to someone that you had become almost the same person. We were upstairs later, smoking weed Connie had stolen from Peter, stuffing the space below the door with the fat twist of a towel. She kept having to pinch the rolling paper shut again with her fingers, the two of us smoking in our solemn, hothouse silence. I could see Peter's car out the window, parked awry, like he'd had to abandon it under great duress. I'd always been aware of Peter, in the way I liked any older boy at that age, their mere existence demanding attention. But my feelings were suddenly amplified and pressing, as exaggerated and inevitable as events seem in dreams. I stuffed myself on banalities of him, the t-shirts he wore in rotation, the tender skin where the back of his neck disappeared into his collar, the looping horns of Paul Revere and the Raiders sounding from his bedroom, how he'd sometimes stumble around with a proud, overt secrecy, so I would know he had taken acid, filling and refilling a glass of water in the kitchen with extravagant care. I'd gone into Peter's bedroom while Connie was showering. It reeked of what I'd later identify as masturbation, a damp rupture in the air. All his possessions suffused with a mysterious import, his low futon, a plastic bag full of ashy-looking nugs by his pillow, manuals to become a trainee mechanic. The glass on the floor, greased with fingerprints, was half full of stale-looking water, and there was a line of smooth river stones on the top of his dresser. A cheap copper bracelet I had seen him wear sometimes. I took in everything as if I could decode the private meaning of each object, puzzle together the interior architecture of his life. So much of desire, at that age, was a willful act. Trying so hard to slur the rough, disappointing edges of boys into the shape of someone we could love. We spoke of our desperate need for them with rote and familiar words, like we were reading lines from a play. Later, I would see this, how impersonal and grasping our love was, pinging around the universe, hoping for a host to give form to our wishes. When I was young, I'd seen magazines in a drawer of the bathroom, my father's magazines, the pages bloated with humidity, the insides crowded with women. The tautness of mesh pulled across crotches, the gauzy light that made their skin illuminate and pale. My favorite girl had a gingham ribbon tied around her throat in a bow. It was so odd and stirring that someone could be naked but also wear a ribbon around her neck. It made her nakedness formal. I visited the magazine with the regularity of a penitent, replacing it carefully each time, locking the bathroom door with breathless, ill pleasure that quickly morphed into rubbing my crotch along the seams of carpets, the seam of my mattress, the back of a couch. How did it work, even, that by holding the hovering image of the girl in my mind, I could build the sensation, a sheet of pleasure that grew until it was compulsive, the desire to feel that way again and again? It seemed strange that it was a girl I was imagining, not a boy, and that the feeling could be reignited by other oddities, a color plate illustration in my fairy tale book of a girl trapped in a spider's web, the faceted eyes of evil creatures watching her, the memory of my father cupping a neighbor's ass through her wet swimsuit. I'd done things before, not quite sex, but close. The dry fumbles in the hallways of school dances, the overheated suffocation of a parent's couch, the backs of my knees sweaty. Alex Posner worming his hand down my shorts in his exploratory, detached fashion, jerking away roughly when we heard footsteps. None of it. The kissing, the clawing hand in my underwear, the raw jumpiness of a penis in my fist, seemed in any way kin to what I did alone. The spread of pressure, like stairs going up. I imagine Peter almost as a corrective to my own desires, whose compulsion sometimes frightened me. I lay back on the thin tapestry covering Connie's bed. She had a bad sunburn. I watched her rub cloudy skin loose from her shoulder and roll it into tiny gray balls. My faint revulsion was tempered by the thought of Peter, who lived in the same house as Connie, who breathed the same air, who ate from the same utensils. They were conflated in an essential way, like two different species raised in the same laboratory. From downstairs, I heard Pamela's tripping laugh. "When I get a boyfriend, I'm going to make him take me out to dinner," Connie said with authority. "She doesn't even mind Peter just brings her here to screw." Peter never wore underwear, Connie had complained, and the fact grew in my mind, making me nauseous in a not unpleasant way. The sleepy crease of his eyes from his permanent high. Connie paled in comparison. I didn't really believe that friendship could be an end in itself, not just the background fuzz to the dramatics of boys loving you or not loving you. Connie stood at the mirror and tried to harmonize with one of the sweet, sorrowful 45s we listened to with fanatic repetition. Songs that overheated my own righteous sadness, my imagined alignment with the tragic nature of the world. How I love to wring myself out that way, stoking my feelings until they were unbearable. I wanted all of life to feel that frantic and pressurized with portent, so even colors and weather and tastes would be more saturated. That's what the songs promised, what they trawled out of me. One song seemed to vibrate with a private echo, as if marked. The simple lines about a woman, about the shape of her back when she turns it on the man for the last time, the ashes she leaves in bed from her cigarettes. The song played once through, and Connie hopped up to flip the record. "Play it again," I said. I tried to imagine myself in the same way the singer saw the woman, the dangle of her silver bracelet tinged with green, the fall of her hair. But I only felt foolish, opening my eyes to the sight of Connie at the mirror, separating her eyelashes with a safety pin, her shorts wedged into her ass. It wasn't the same to notice things about yourself. Only certain girls ever called forth that kind of attention, like the girl I'd seen in the park, or Pamela and the girls on the high school steps, waiting for the lazy agitation of their boyfriends' idling cars, the signal to leap to their feet, to brush off their seat, and trip out into the full sun, waving goodbye to the ones left behind. Soon after that day, I'd gone to Peter's room while Connie was sleeping. His comment to me in the kitchen felt like a time-stamped invitation I had to redeem before it slipped away. Connie and I had drunk beer before bed, lounging against the wicker legs of her furniture and scooping cottage cheese from a tub with our fingers. I drank much more than she had. I wanted some other momentum to take over, forcing action. I didn't want to be like Connie, never changing, waiting around for something to happen, eating an entire sleeve of sesame crackers, then doing 10 jumping jacks in her room. I stayed awake after Connie passed into her deep, twitchy sleep, listening for Peter's footsteps on the stairs. He crashed to his room, finally, and I waited for what seemed like a long time before I followed, creeping along the hallway like a specter in shorty pajamas, their polyester slickness stuck in the broody stretch between princess costumes and lingerie. The silence of the house was a living thing, oppressive and present, but also coloring everything with a foreign freedom, filling the rooms like a denser air. Peter's form under the blankets was still, his knobby man's feet exposed. I heard his breathing, brambled from the after effects of whatever drugs he'd taken. His room seemed to cradle him. This might have been enough, to watch him sleep as a parent would, indulging the privilege of imagining happy dreams. His breaths like the beads of a rosary, each in and out a comfort. But I didn't want it to be enough. When I got closer, his face clarified, his features completing as I adjusted to the dark. I let myself watch him without shame. Peter opened his eyes suddenly, and somehow didn't seem startled by my presence at his bedside, giving me a look as mild as a glass of milk. "Boyd," he said, his voice still drifty from sleep. But he blinked, and there was a resignation in the way he said my name that made me feel he'd been waiting for me, that he'd known I would come. I was embarrassed to be standing like I was. "You can sit," he said. I crouched by the futon, hovering foolishly, my legs already starting to burn with effort. Peter reached a hand to pull me fully onto the mattress, and I smiled, though I wasn't sure he could even see my face. He was quiet, and so was I. His room looked strange as seen from the floor, the bulk of the dresser, the slivered doorway. I couldn't imagine Connie in the rooms beyond. Connie mumbling in her sleep, as she often did, sometimes announcing a number like an addled bingo player. "You can get under the blankets if you're cold," he said, caping open the covers so I saw his bare chest, his nakedness. I got in beside him with ritual silence. It was as easy as this. I'd entered a possibility that had always been there. He didn't speak after that, and neither did I. He hitched me close, so my back was pressed against his chest, and I could feel his dick rear against my thighs. I didn't want to breathe, feeling that it would be an imposition on him. Even the fact of my ribs rising and falling, too much of a bother. I was taking tiny breaths through my nose, a lightheadedness overtaking me. The strident rank of him in the dark, his blankets, his sheets. It was what Pamela got all the time, this easy occupation of his presence. His arm was around me, a weight I kept identifying as the weight of a boy's arm. Peter acted like he was going to sleep, the casual sigh and shuffle. But that kept the whole thing together. You had to act as if nothing strange were happening. When he brushed my nipple with his finger, I kept very still. I could feel his steady breath on my neck, his hand taking an impersonal measurement, twisting the nipple so I inhaled audibly, and he hesitated for a moment, but kept going, his dick smearing at my bare thighs. I would be shunted along whatever would happen, I understood, however he piloted the night. And there wasn't fear, just a feeling adjacent to excitement, a viewing from the wings. What would happen to Evie? When the floorboards creaked from the hall, the spell cracked. Peter withdrew his hand, rolling abruptly onto his back, staring at the ceiling so I could see his eyes. "I've got to get some sleep," he said in a voice carefully drained. A voice like an eraser, its insistent dullness meant to make me wonder if anything had happened. And I was slow to get to my feet, a little stunned, but also in a happy swoon, like even that little bit had fed me. The boys played the slot machine for what seemed like hours. Connie and I sat on the bench, vibrating with forced inattention. I kept waiting for some acknowledgement from Peter of what had happened, a catch in the eye, a glance serrated with our history. But he didn't look at me. The humid garage smelled of chilly concrete and the funk of camping tents, folded while still wet. The gas station calendar on the wall. A woman in a hot tub with the stilled eyes and bared teeth of taxidermy. I was grateful for Pamela's absence that night. There'd been some fight between her and Peter, Connie had told me. I wanted to ask for more details, but there was a warning in her face. I couldn't be too interested.
"Don't you kids have somewhere better to be?" Henry asked. "Some ice cream social somewhere?"
Connie tossed her hair, then walked over to get more beer. Henry watched her approach with amusement.
"Give those to me,"
she whined, when Henry held two bottles out of reach. I remember noticing for the first time how loud she was, her voice hard with silly aggressiveness. Connie with her whines and feints, the grating laugh that sounded and was practiced. A space opened up between us as soon as I started to notice these things, to catalog her shortcomings the way a boy would. I regret how ungenerous I was. As if by putting distance between us, I could cure myself of the same disease.
"What are you going to give me for them?" Henry said. "Nothing's free in this world, Connie."
She shrugged, then lunged for the beers. Henry pressed the solid mass of his body against her, grinning as she struggled. Peter rolled his eyes. He didn't like this kind of thing either, the bleeding vaudeville. He had older friends who disappeared in sluggish jungles, rivers thick with sediment, who'd returned home babbling and addicted to tiny black cigarettes, their hometown girlfriends cowering behind them like nervous little shadows. I tried to sit up straighter, to compose my face with adult boredom, willing Peter to look over. I wanted the parts of him I was sure Pamela couldn't see, the pricks of sorrow I sometimes caught in his gaze, or the secret kindness he showed to Connie, taking us to Arrowhead Lake the year their mother had forgotten Connie's birthday entirely. Pamela didn't know those things, and I held on to that certainty, whatever leverage might belong to me alone. Henry pinched the soft skin above the waist of Connie's shorts.
"Hungry lately, huh?"
"Don't touch me, perv,"
she said, hitting his hand away. She giggled a little.
"Fuck you."
"Fine," he said, grabbing Connie's hands by the wrist. "Fuck me."
She tried half-heartedly to pull away, whining until Henry finally let her go. She rubbed her wrists.
"Asshole,"
she muttered. But she wasn't really mad. That was part of being a girl. You were resigned to whatever feedback you'd get. If you got mad, you were crazy. And if you didn't react, you were a bitch. The only thing you could do was smile from the corner they'd backed you into. Implicate yourself in the joke, even if the joke was always on you. I didn't like the taste of beer. The granular bitterness, nothing like the pleasing hygienic chill of my father's martinis. But I drank one, and then another. The boys fed the slot machine from a shopping bag full of nickels until they were almost out of coins.
"We need the machine keys," Peter said, lighting a thin joint he pulled from his pocket, "so we can open it up."
"I'll get them," Connie said. "Don't miss me too much,"
she crooned to Henry, fluttering a little wave before she left. To me, she just raised her eyebrows. I understood this was part of some plan she had hatched to get Henry's attention, to leave, then return. She had probably read about it in a magazine.
"That was our mistake, I think, one of many mistakes,
to believe that boys were acting with a logic that we could someday understand, to believe that their actions had any meaning beyond thoughtless impulse. We were like conspiracy theorists, seeing portent and intention in every detail, wishing desperately that we mattered enough to be the object of planning and speculation. But they were just boys, silly and young and straightforward. They weren't hiding anything." Peter let the lever ratchet to a starting position and stepped back to give Henry a turn, the two of them passing the joint back and forth. They both wore white t-shirts that were thin from washings. Peter smiled at the carnival racket when the slot machine clattered out a pile of coins, but he seemed distracted, finishing another beer, smoking the joint until it was crushed and oily. They were speaking low. I heard bits and pieces. They were talking about Willie Potorak. We all knew him, the first boy in Petaluma to enlist. His father had driven him to register. I'd seen him later at the Hamburger Hamlet with a petite brunette whose nostrils streamed snot. She called him stubbornly by his full name, William, like the extra syllable was the secret password that would transform him into a grown, responsible man. She clung to him like a burr. "He's always out in the driveway," Peter said, "washing his car like nothing's different. He can't even drive anymore, I don't think." This was news from the other world. I felt ashamed, seeing Peter's face, for how I only play-acted at real feelings, reaching for the world through songs. Peter could actually be sent away. He could actually die. He didn't have to force himself to feel that way, the emotional exercises Connie and I occupied ourselves with. What would you do if your father died? What would you do if you got pregnant? What would you do if a teacher wanted to fuck you, like Mr. Garrison and Patricia Bell? It was all puckered, his stump, Peter said. Pink. Disgusting, Henry said from the machine. He didn't turn away from the looping images of cherries that scrolled in front of him. You want to kill people? You better be okay with those people blowing your legs off. He's proud of it, too, Peter said, his voice rising as he flicked the end of the joint onto the garage floor. He watched it snuff out. Wanting people to see it? That's what's crazy. The dramatics of their conversation made me feel dramatic, too. I was stirred by the alcohol, the burn in my chest I exaggerated, until I became moved by an authority not my own. I stood up. The boys didn't notice. They were talking about a movie they had seen in San Francisco. I recognized the title. They hadn't shown it in town because it was supposed to be perverted, though I couldn't remember why. When I finally watched the movie, as an adult, the palpable innocence of the sex scenes surprised me. The humble pudge of fat above the actress's pubic hair. How she laughed when she pulled the yacht captain's face to her saggy, lovely breasts. There was a good-natured quality to the raunch, like fun was still an erotic idea. Unlike the movies that came later, girls wincing while their legs dangled like a dead thing's. Henry was fluttering his eyelids, tongue in an obscene rictus, aping some scene from the movie. Peter laughed. Sick. They wondered aloud whether the actress had actually been getting fucked. They didn't seem to care that I was standing right there. You could tell she liked it, Henry said.
Oh, he crowed in a high, feminine voice. Oh, yeah,
He banged the slot machine with his hips. I saw it, too. I spoke before thinking. I wanted an entry point in the conversation, even if it was a lie. They both looked at me. Well, Henry said, the ghost finally speaks. I flushed. You saw it? Peter seemed doubtful. I told myself he was being protective.
Yeah,
I said. Pretty wild. They exchanged a glance. Did I really think they'd believe I had somehow gotten a ride to the city? That I'd gone to see what was essentially a porno? So, Henry's eyes glinted, what was your favorite part?
That part you were talking about, I said, with the girl.
But what part of that did you like best? Henry said. Leave her alone, Peter said mildly, already bored. Did you like the Christmas scene? Henry continued. His smile lulled me into thinking we were having a real conversation, that I was making progress. The big tree?
all the snow? I nodded, almost believing my own lie. Henry laughed. The movie was in Fiji. The whole thing's on an island. Henry was snorting, helpless with laughter, and cut a look at Peter, who seemed embarrassed for me, like you would be embarrassed for a stranger who tripped on the street. Like nothing had ever happened between us at all. I pushed Henry's motorcycle. I hadn't expected it to tip over, not really. Maybe just wobble, just enough to interrupt Henry so he'd be scared for a second, so he'd make some jokey exclamations of dismay and forget my lie. But I had pushed with real force. The motorcycle fell over and crunched hard on the cement floor. Henry stared at me. "You little bitch." He hurried to the downed motorcycle like it was a shot pet, practically cradling it in his arms. "It's not broken," I said, inanely. "You're a fucking nutcase," he muttered. He ran his hands along the body of the bike and held a shard of orange metal up to Peter. "You believe this shit?" When Peter looked at me, his face solidified with pity, which was somehow worse than anger. I was like a child, warranting only abbreviated emotions. Connie appeared in the doorway. "Knock, knock," she called, the keys hanging from a crooked finger. She took in the scene, Henry squatting by the motorcycle, Peter's arms crossed. Henry let out a harsh laugh. "Your friend's a real bitch," he said, shooting me a look. "Evie knocked it over," Peter said. "You fucking kids," Henry said. "Get a babysitter next time. Don't hang around with us. Fuck." "I'm sorry," I said, my voice small. But nobody was listening. Even after Peter helped Henry right the motorcycle, peering closely at the brake. "It's just cosmetic," he announced. "We can fix it pretty easy." I understood that other things had broken. Connie studied me with cold wonder, like I'd betrayed her, and maybe I had. I'd done what we were not supposed to do. Illuminated a slice of private weakness, exposed the twitchy rabbit heart.